I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday the 16th of July, and as we record this in the early evening, the latest Department of Health figures show that two more deaths with COVID-19 have been reported in the last 24 hours, bringing total fatalities to 1,749. 21 cases were also reported, bringing the total here to 25,698. Meanwhile, on the global level, according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker, 13.6 million cases have been recorded around the world and 585,000 people have died. Since last week's episode, that's a rise of 1.5 million recorded cases and 35,000 deaths, and last week saw respective rises of the same order. So you don't need this podcast to tell you that things are going in the wrong direction. Last night, the government here confirmed that it certainly thought so by not progressing to phase 4 in lifting restrictions. And we'll get some detail on that in just a moment with our correspondent Sinead Crowley, who attended the National Public Health Emergency Team's briefing this evening. Now, later in this longer episode, longer because I'm taking some leave and will be away for a couple of weeks, and you can listen to this in one go, or you can listen to it in stages. Listener, it's up to you. We're going to be hearing from two Irish women in different parts of the world, Breed McGrath, who's from Tipperary, but in Chile at the moment, where a lockdown really means a lockdown. And we'll be hearing from Olivia Hayden from Offaly. She's with the International Organisation for Migration. She's been trying to highlight the plight of Ethiopian migrants bound for the Gulf states who got stuck in Yemen due to COVID-19. But first, as I said, let's go to that call with Sinead Crowley.
Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Colm.
You're clearly not a publican.
No. I am, however, a parent, and we did hear at the NEFET briefing today that reopening schools is a core priority. So I think I'm holding on to that as one of the lines out of the Department of Health briefing this evening.
Okay, right. Well, we'll get into the NEFET briefing just in a moment, but seeing as we're a once weekly podcast, well, let's have a bit of a recap on what happened yesterday. We're staying in stage 3. There had been a hope that stage 3 would end on Monday and we'd progress to stage 4. That's not happening. So what's staying the same and what's not happening as expected?
Yeah, it was an unusual week. Everything had gone really according to plan up until now. From moving to stage to stage, as we know, there had been a 3-week gap. Usually towards the beginning of the third week, it looked good and you would kind of have a fair idea that it was happening. And then what had happened up till now would be the Taoiseach would say definitely on a Friday, yes, it's all happening on Monday and so on. But this week, the signs weren't good from early on this week. And then yesterday it was confirmed that we wouldn't be moving to the final stage, which was due to take place on Monday. And it all came down to our old friend, the R number. There was a warning last week that it was approaching or possibly over 1. But certainly now today it is confirmed that with all of the best technology and with all of the best maths and modelling available to them, it does look like it's well over 1. Now, it is hard to be specific because we're still talking about quite low numbers, thankfully. So it's very hard to be specific about the R number. But the best estimate is it's at around 1.4. Could be as low as 1.2 or it could be as high as 1.8. And that 1.8 certainly is not a figure they want, because that would see a serious increase in cases in the weeks and months ahead. So obviously that they decided to put the brakes on and not go to the next phase. And the big one, I suppose, that people felt was the big impact was the pubs, the non-food serving pubs, we'll call them, or the traditional pubs, because they had been, and nightclubs as well, actually, but the pubs had been planning on opening on Monday, and, you know, a lot of them had made plans about that and maybe had laid in stock or whatever, but that's now been deferred until August the 10th. And actually, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, suggesting today that it might even be delayed further. I suppose what he would mean by that is, you know, they're waiting to see how this situation at the moment unfolds. It's a note of caution everywhere, really.
Yeah, the dates are not fixed. It's data dependent. In fact, we've seen...
Exactly.
You can view them as a restriction or precautionary measures. So we've seen masks introduced on public transport. That's now going to be extended to shops, although without the same hard threat backing it up.
Yeah, I mean, and what was very obvious from what was said this evening over the last couple of days is this is a situation that we're learning from all the time, you know. And I suppose Netherton, it's a brand new disease, it's a brand new virus, so they're learning from it all the time. And, you know, in the beginning, masks weren't mandatory, then on public transport now, they do want people to wear them. It does seem to be the case that this is a disease that's passed on inside. And, you know, if you think back to the early days, they were worried about children, they were worried about various things. Now it seems to be it's inside, it's people in congregated settings, as I said, they put it, people who are close to each other, people who can't social distance, and people inside. And it's those sorts of places that they want people to wear masks.
Right. So the limit on the recommended number of people visiting households, it's 10 people visiting a household. They shouldn't be from more than 4 households. The limits on gathering indoors, that's staying at 50 instead of rising to 100, which dashed the plans of people who may have been planning on getting married.
Yes.
Outdoor gathering stays at 100, and non-essential foreign travel still recommended that people don't engage in that. You said congregated settings. We've seen some clusters in nursing homes, but there's another particular area of concern. We keep hearing house parties being mentioned.
Yeah, house parties seem to be the really big problem. And I suppose the problem with a house party literally is that, you know, there's nobody in control other than maybe the person who's hosting the party. But to an extent in other settings, whether it's a pub or a hotel or a theatre, or, you know, you would have somebody booking the venue and organising it. But at a house party, it's whoever is there, and usually alcohol would be consumed and so on. And it does seem to be a problem. And again, there's this warning against it. You know, they're trying to reduce the number of people who meet particularly indoors. In fact, tonight it was even suggested that if you could meet the same people every week, that would be even better. You know, if you had, it's not that there's a rule about it or anything, but obviously it would be preferable to meet the same people every week rather than meet 10 people one week and 10 people another week. But really what they're trying to limit is people congregating indoors, and obviously when you throw alcohol into the mix, or if you have younger people or whatever, then there's a lack of social distancing. Yeah. And that is the big problem.
Loud music, people speaking in each other's faces. Let's face it, house parties aren't great for changing the old towels in the bathrooms, and who knows, maybe the hand washing isn't what it could be. We heard mention of people coming from abroad as well. There was this issue about flights coming in from the States. Perhaps it was somewhat overstated, but it did happen, even if some of those people were Irish people returning home.
It did, but again, certainly at the briefing tonight, Dr. Ronan Lynn was not pointing a finger particularly at people coming from abroad. It was, I suppose, the message that's coming out very strongly at this stage is it is up to people's individual behaviour. So, for example, it actually doesn't, if you think about it logically, it doesn't matter if the disease has come into the country as long as you're not doing a behaviour that will allow to spread, if you know what I mean. So as long as you stay 2 metres from somebody and you keep your hand washing and you keep your social distancing, then you won't catch that virus. So again, there's this sort of emphasis on personal responsibility and on wearing the masks and on doing all those things that will keep the virus from spreading no matter where it comes from, because it's still being passed by community transmission. You know, that's still, I think it's around 60%, but it's still the people in the country that appear to be passing it as well. It's not this case that simply the travel is behind it all. You know, it is still here in small numbers, thankfully, but it is being passed here.
Well, one of the good news stories, I suppose, was the amount of people who, notwithstanding all the caveats you have to add to this, that you need a particularly modern operating system on your phone to download the contact tracing app. But insofar as a lot of people can download the app, they have downloaded the app. But another concern was raised with contact tracing. We heard about it today, that not everybody who has been contacted by contact tracing is signing up to actually cooperate with this system. I think it's about 1 in 5?
Yeah, that is a big problem. And that goes back, it even predates the app, because it's something we heard from the HSE earlier in this pandemic, that people who are considered to be close contacts weren't coming forward, or often there'd be 2 tests. There'd be a day 0 and a day 7, and they might come forward the first time and not come forward the second time. And there's a couple of issues there. First of all, is that there's a lot of asymptomatic transmission. A lot of people can carry this virus and not know or not feel ill. And there's a worry and there's a supposition that maybe they get the call to go for tracing or to go for testing, and they think, well, I feel fine, so that doesn't apply to me. But that's not the case, because a significant number of people can carry this virus and not know it. So absolutely, if you get the call to come for testing, you should do so. There's always this. There's also the suggestion, given the emphasis on house parties, and that there might be maybe an embarrassment or a sense that, you know, you did the wrong thing by catching it. If you did catch it in a congregated setting or at a party, so maybe you might be embarrassed. So certainly that message has gone out on a number of occasions at this stage. Just go and get the test. You know, it's not a finger wagging thing. It's a case that they really need to know where this thing is being passed on. And certainly in relation to the younger people, we know now, again, it's mostly younger people seem to be among these new cases. they might feel fine, but they could be going home to people who are vulnerable, or quite simply, as I say, spreading it asymptomatically. And they really are trying to put a lid on that.
So I suppose, Sinead, with your other hat on, you must have a degree of sympathy for people in the arts community, theatres and venues and these places. That's the kibosh put on any opening up of that sector anytime soon, which is already in a bad enough situation.
Yeah, it's in a really bad situation. Musicians, performers, actors, and we have seen a great deal of resilience from the sector and actually a great deal of creativity as well. I mean, we saw the Abbey launch its plans this week that has a kind of a mixture of both Zoom theatre and live theatre, and in particular theatre outdoors in the grounds of IMA. So they are really trying. We know there'll be a limited theatre, Dublin Theatre Festival. We've seen other arts festivals around the country, and my colleagues have reported on them doing the best they can to get up and running. But yeah, I mean, for anybody who involved big groups of people, this would be a blow. Now, I have to say, and this is my own supposition, from listening to the briefing this evening, it does appear to be the case that, for example, large gatherings are outside does seem to be a lot less risky than inside. That's certainly one of the things they've learned. So, you know, it may be possible to have larger groups of people outside. Dr. Ronan Glynn did talk today about nuance in various settings, that the more they learn about the disease, the more nuanced they can be in the future. So, for example, maybe a blanket ban at one stage mightn't be a blanket ban in another stage. So maybe it might be possible to have, say, theatre outside or larger groups of people outside. They're learning from this all the time. But certainly, yeah, in the short term, I mean, not being able to have groups of people inside is a big blow for anybody who earns their living or simply enjoys performances in the performing arts. And by the way, if you're thinking of getting into a nightclub anytime soon, that really does not seem to happen, because that question was asked at the briefing as well tonight. And it's the nightclubs were supposed to come back to pubs, But now, obviously, they've been pushed back to August the 10th. But certainly the feeling from the briefing tonight was that mightn't happen either, that a nightclub, late at night, loud music, alcohol and so on is just not the type of place that they want open in terms of this virus being spread. So I don't think they'll be dancing inside in the near future.
Right. Well, finally, one thing is happening on Monday, Sinead, that they said would be happening on Monday, whatever about the lifting of restrictions or anything else, the publication of the so-called green list countries where people can fly in, or Irish people can fly to, where quarantining won't be required as people arrive back from those countries or arrive here from those countries.
Yeah, but there's a bit of uncertainty still about that as well. NPHET is not uncertain. NPHET doesn't want people to travel outside the country. It's as simple as that. Non-essential travel, they don't want it. They've said that all along. They've been quite clear. We're now told that there will be this green list. However, the green list still comes with the proviso that they'd rather you didn't travel in the first place. So It's going to be very much up to the individual as to what they do. NPHET aren't going to stand in the way of a green list. They said tonight they don't know what's on it, by the way. And they won't stand in the way of it. And if you're travelling to a country that has a low incidence of the disease, and if you take all the precautions there, then, you know, logic dictates that you're not going to be at any more of a risk than you will be travelling around this country. However, it still comes with the proviso that they don't want non-essential travel. So Whereas this green list may allow you to go and come back without having to quarantine for the 14 days, it's still not saying absolutely go on your holidays on Monday. They're still clearly asking people to really reflect on whether they need to take that trip or not.
Right. It's kind of advantage NPHET at the moment, isn't it? Because it was a political decision to amalgamate some of the phases together, and the R number has gone up. So NPHET's advice may be taken even more seriously than it was already taken, not to say it wasn't taken seriously before this.
Yeah, and in fairness, I think it was said tonight at the briefing that, you know, no decision, wasn't that it happened too quickly before. They acted on the information available to them at the time, and the information, things were going very, very well for quite a while there, and the information available to them made them feel that they could open up the way they did. So it's not like there's, you know, a split or a disagreement or anything, but clearly the information now is that they shouldn't, and that they should put the brakes on it for a while. But important to say as well that at the end of tonight's briefing, Dr. Ronan Glynn kind of came back around in a circle really and said, look, we are still in a good position. You know, it's not like things have gone drastically wrong. We are still in a good position, but what we need to do is keep that position. He said education was a core principle, getting the health services fully back up and running is a core principle. So what they want to do really is get people to start taking care again. And they have said on several occasions that people did do what they were asked, and they did put a lot of effort into protecting their community. So I suppose what they're asking people is to just take a look around now and say, I think, you know, there was solidarity before, and we did manage to get this, to flatten the curve and to get the R number down. And they're asking people now to take a step back and to take care again and get that R number back below one, so we can do all the things we want to do, like move freely and like get the schools open. Because the point was also made that the only real way to have health and schools and free movement and pubs and anything you want is to have no disease in the community, or to have absolute minimal disease in the community. So by working on that, then you get all the other issues that you want.
Alrighty. Thanks, Sinead. All the
best.
All
right. Thanks, Colin. Bye.
Bye. On the first of two interviews with Irish women abroad in this episode, we're going to hear from Breed McGrath from Tipperary, who lives in Chile with her partner, who's Chilean, and their new baby. Now, the last time I spoke to Breed was back in December, when mass protests thronged the streets of the capital. This time, things in Santiago are very different. Okay, Breed, yeah. So how are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Yeah,
hope you're all well.
Yeah, not too bad. Just remind me, how long have you been in Chile now?
So I have been in Chile since the end of October 2018.
Right, and as far as lockdowns go, this is not your first rodeo, so to speak.
This is not. Now, the first one, I have to say, was entirely voluntary, from I think October to just before the second lockdown here. There were quite a lot of protests on the street. Things were violent to a certain extent, but the real danger being that the flashpoints could come off at any given occasion. They were linked to metro stations. We live near a metro station. And it was essentially as well, it was the preponderance of tear gas, which does linger for quite some time and would be a terrible thing to put, at that stage, it was a newborn baby, through. So for reasons of caution, but more particularly so the baby didn't ever have to be crying for 24 hours or worse, I didn't go out during that time with him.
Yeah, so how long was that for?
I think that was for maybe two to three months.
So you got through that, and then along came COVID.
Yeah.
The word lockdown is a catch-all. So what kind of a lockdown are you in at the moment, and how locked down are you?
Entirely locked down. Not to be too dramatic about it, but it is essentially house arrest here. You cannot go out except with police permission for now, a maximum of twice a week. Again, maximum of 4 hours in that twice a week, and only for essential items or essential appointments that you have cleared in advance with police. And then there is a curfew in the evening time from 10 o'clock, where regardless of your excuse, I think unless it's a situation of life or death, you cannot be found on the streets at all. Let's say, for example, you want to go to the supermarket. First, you have to get your police permission. And I suppose that would be very difficult for lots of people who, for whatever reason, the police might have a file on them. But anyway, if you're okay on that score, you then go to the supermarket. They check that you have your police permission in the really long queue. Then they take your temperature. They disinfect your feet. You disinfect your hands. And everybody, and when I say everybody, 100% of people on the street, and there are not that many at any given time, are wearing a mask and giving each other a very wide berth. Twice a week maximum, and for essential items, that's it.
And is it any different otherwise, the fact that you're not a Chilean citizen? I mean, you're there, your partner is Chilean. Does an Irish passport disadvantage you in any way?
It does. So some places are more strict on that than others. Some you can explain in your kind of very blatantly foreign way just how foreign you are, and people can look kindly on you. Others are just, you know, the rules rule. So I would say the vast majority of any outside activity has been done by Roberto, not by me, for that simple reason. You can get your police permission with a passport.
What kind of rigmarole do you have to go through to get the police permission?
It's an online form. And I suppose they know how many times you've been out before. You know, you have to say what it is for, and you have to then stick exactly to do that.
Right.
And we've heard of people who have been stopped by the police and they look for your, well, if in the supermarket, they're looking for your police permission, they're even doing the police work for them. But you absolutely, people are being stopped all the time. And you see, there's so little traffic, either pedestrian or motor vehicle, that you're very obvious.
And how many times have you been out?
I've been out for the essential items, but you can't bring a baby. So you can't bring a baby to the park. You can't bring a baby anywhere. Now, there was a minor, so we were in the communes or the districts that were locked down in the very beginning, the ones that had COVID from the start due to international travel. Then there was a relaxation of that, a mild relaxation of that in April. So I was out for walks at that time. I remember that being a great luxury. But then, as was really obvious, when you only lock down certain parts of a city or a country, that's never going to cut it. So then the whole city is in lockdown now. So how many times have I been out? I couldn't tell you, but I know I made use of that relaxation when you could at that point go out for exercise.
Right. So the old freezer aisle in the supermarket seems like an exotic location at this stage.
Ireland is a total paradise for me now. I have to say, you become, aside from general homesickness, which I think most, foreign travelers have in fits and starts or on a low level all the time, Ireland looks like a place of spectacular governance and of just bucolic wonder and space. It's another thing that Ireland has, I suppose, that we don't realize. It's the low density of housing to a certain extent. And most people, a lot of people would have gardens, which would be a lot more than here. And just generally, especially if you were a rural dweller, I feel that lockdown, looking at my family in Tipperary, was not nearly as onerous as here.
And Camira, who enforces it on the streets in Chile? Are you dealing with police? Is it a combination of police and military, or is there a kind of an ad hoc civilian warden system? Who do you see on the streets
So
checking
it's
clients?
all three really. So it's, I think more so it's probably the military enforced the curfew maybe, but it's police and military. And as I said, the supermarkets and certain shops now, again, that's quite ad hoc, are enforcing it by themselves. So I didn't understand that a supermarket would look for your papers before they would let you in, but now that's what they're doing. And people in generally, I think they're like, they look aghast at anyone who is not in a mask, which I've seen maybe like 1 or 2% of that. And everybody walks very much around each other, very far away from each other. People are very suspicious now.
And I mean, how is that? What's it like to be locked down in an apartment, unable to bring your child outside, having your papers checked, constant scrutiny? I mean, I know that's a lot of questions in a row, but what would you say the net effect of all of that is?
It's a tale of two cities. Like in the beginning, you're very, or I found I was very enthusiastic and motivated in the sense of, and now I will do this and learn that and read this. And you set yourself off on various different courses, etc. I think though you realize as well in many ways how lucky you are because you have a lot of time to ruminate, as well. We're safe. We're well. I know of a friend of mine, her partner is Irish, and what they do is they spend 90 days in Ireland, 90 days in Chile, 90 days in Ireland, 90 days in Chile. And just in mid-March, the Chilean lady, her flight was 3 days before her Irish partner, and then her Irish partner never made it. So they're bereft, and that is literally by just a cruel twist of fate. So I am, in many ways, in a very good position in comparison to lots of other people that I have seen or heard. There's no homeschooling as well, I suppose, going on here. I feel sorry for the child who I think believes there's only two people in the universe and there's only 4 rooms or 5 rooms in his world. A child who's very sociable before. And I think routines are a little bit difficult to maintain in that context. But he's fine, he's happy-go-lucky, he's fine. Technology is a great savior. Lots of people in Ireland and abroad have taken to Zoom and Google Meets and WhatsApp video. And I think I'm a lot more connected to friends around the world had there not been a lockdown. So it swings and roundabouts. As I say, you fantasize about beaches and parks and sand and just touching the natural world. Or if you're a very social person like I am, you miss that aspect of life. But really, it's turned into a counter blessings time for me. Ultimately, I do feel lucky. You know, everybody is okay. Home is a place, but home is also, you know, that like a state of mind. And I'm home now with the little family and we're all doing okay. And to that extent, I really feel I can't complain.
When you look at, insofar as you can tell from, you know, the Chilean family members and other people that you have contact with, what's it like, that sort of almost draconian crackdown given Chile's history? Are people nervous that, you know, the tide of authority may not recede as quickly as they'd like, given the recent demonstrations when we spoke to you before, the demos on the streets and the curfews then? I mean, does it create any nervousness, or are people entirely bought into it on the basis that it's for a public health thing?
I think, to be honest, most people are bought into it for now because the numbers are so high here, you know. So it's about 321,000 confirmed cases, probably much higher. They see that Latin America is doing very badly in general and Chile is up there. So in that sense, there's not complaining. What I think people would worry about is the people had reclaimed the streets to a large extent during that major protest movement that was ongoing and only gathering steam and only becoming more mainstream and in many ways achieving great political outcomes as it marched along. I think the tragedy is how that has stopped. And you wonder, you know, once a movement loses momentum, what happens to that? Government approval ratings, even though the response has been like very patchy and remedial efforts have also been very patchy and not a patch on Ireland, their approval ratings have gone up somewhat. Again, that's a classic move. I think, I mean, you wouldn't know, but you feel the government to a large extent are delighted that the streets are empty and there's no either trouble or political difficulties. I think the people of Chile got very angry when there was a photograph of the president in Plaza La Dignidad, as it's called now, Plaza Italia, the main place where all the protests gather. And he was sitting by himself, very contemplative, with the idea being that he was essentially reclaiming that space that they believe is the people's. So that was the image that upset people, that they felt was offensive in many ways to the movement. I think the cause of social justice or a new constitution has been delayed, obviously. The question is, has it been set back? And is the government very comfortable with its new powers? That will remain to be seen, to be honest, when eventually we do come out of lockdown. But definitely the momentum is gone. The focus has shifted. It's all on numbers. It's all on health. It's all on masks. It's all on disinfectant. It's this, I suppose it's very similar to a large extent as the way the conversation shifted at home. But it will have to face up to the old problems again. And in many ways, exacerbation of those old problems. For example, there are supposed to be food parcels going to poor people who most definitely would need them. And I've heard two instances that I know of where the food parcels went to people who were quite well off and fine. So it looks like that's not targeted at all. It's just by sector rather than by household. I think, again, rescue efforts are not sufficient for people in the black economy. So I think Chile will come out of it in some ways more economically divided than it was before. But it's just, you know, that spark that it had, that spark on the streets and the feeling that let's all together, we can change this. I think that will be slow to come back out again in the numbers that it was before. And it'll take some pretty fine organization by those groups to kick it back up again. People have retreated, you know, all over the world. People have retreated, their worlds have contracted, and they just now try and keep their immediate family safe. And that changes your worldview for a while.
All right. Well, that's a good point to leave it. I have an 11-month-old here in the background myself who is think, starting a bit of a protest of her own. So we'll wrap up the conversation there.
Very good. All right. Thanks a million.
Okay, listen, thanks a million. Now, this next interview isn't so much about the virus COVID-19 as the direct effects of travel restrictions on one very vulnerable group of people. We've looked at the situation in Yemen before and the healthcare system there, or rather the lack of it. And we're going to return to Yemen today, not to look at the war or COVID-19, but rather how thousands of Ethiopian migrants who transit through Yemen with the help of traffickers are now trapped there. Olivia Hayden from Offaly works with the International Organization for Migration. She's part of their Yemen team, but at the moment she's in Addis Ababa. And during this interview, you'll hear her refer to authorities in the north and authorities in the south. You may have heard the authorities in the north referred to also as the Houthis as well. Here's Olivia Hayden speaking to me earlier.
Hello.
Hi, Olivia, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
So can you give us an insight into how Yemen has been affected by the COVID situation before we get into how the migration routes are being affected and indeed the migrants themselves?
It is one of the places that's going to be the most affected due to a dysfunctional healthcare system. So the people of Yemen have been living through nearly 6 years of conflict, and this has greatly impacted their hospitals and health clinics. And even before that, it's quite an underdeveloped country. And then if we add on to that they've had some of the biggest outbreaks of cholera in the last couple of years that we've ever seen, they are really high health needs in the country. So now they have this new threat of COVID-19. So if they even did know how many cases they have, they don't have the health capacity to deal with it, to provide the care and treatment for their people. Only around 50% of health facilities are fully functioning in the country, which is pretty scary. But we also don't know how many cases there are across Yemen because they just don't have the test kits. There also isn't always the agreement to announce cases as well because of what they fear it will mean to the community themselves. And additional to that, Yemenis themselves are scared of seeking treatment for COVID because there's so many different rumors about what will happen to them if they do go to a health clinic with the symptoms. People have said things like that they're worried that they'll be given injections to make them even sicker. So people just are not seeking healthcare when they have symptoms.
So that's a kind of a brief snapshot of how Yemen itself is affected. But Yemen is a migrant route, as well as people trying to leave Yemen itself because of the conflict. It's on a migrant route from the Horn of Africa into Saudi Arabia. Who uses it and how has that worked till now?
It isn't usually the destination for migrants, but it's a key transit country. Typically, the people traveling on this route are coming from Ethiopia, over 95%. And usually, they're hoping to reach the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They're typically coming from rural farming backgrounds where there isn't much opportunity at home. They're usually working on the family farm when they're encountered by a smuggler who says to them, you know, if you travel to Saudi, you can make X amount of money, a lot more than you can make here at home. You could build your family a house. You could provide for your parents. You could even buy a car. And I can help you do that if you pay me some money. Usually they're young people who are sold the dream by smugglers, which isn't always the reality. So they leave their homes in rural Ethiopia, often walking or taking buses. Then they'll go to either Djibouti or Somalia. So Ethiopia itself is a landlocked country, so they wouldn't be able to directly get to Yemen from Ethiopia. So they have to go through Djibouti or Somalia. And then they take a boat across the water, the Gulf of Aden, to Yemen. And then when they get to Yemen, they have to transit through the whole country, all the way up to the north and cross the border to Saudi. So of course, all along this journey, there's so many different threats. Within the Horn of Africa itself, walking through the desert, I've had migrants tell me that they've just had to watch their friends drop beside them and continue walking, otherwise they themselves would perish in the desert. Then when they get to the coast in Djibouti or Somalia, they're crammed onto these tiny boats that really shouldn't be in the water at all with even one person on them. You'd have like 100 to 150 people crammed together to make this journey across the Gulf of Aden. And we have reports of people drowning during this journey, of people suffocating on the boats because they're too overcrowded. Then when they get to Yemen itself, they're either taken by smugglers and held in what we call like smuggler dens and tortured while their families back home in Ethiopia are called and extorted money from, or they're able to continue on their way up to Saudi, but having to dodge through the active conflict that's been going on in Yemen for the past nearly 6 years. Sometimes as well, they stop in Yemen to work on farms to make more money to fund the rest of their journey, because each part of the journey costs a certain amount of money. And often before they leave home, they don't actually know the total cost. So they have to stop and work. And that also leads to abuse as well, where they're not paid what was agreed, or they're forced to work for free for long periods. So at every point of this journey, there's different risks and dangers involved. And then once they get to the border between Yemen and Saudi, which is an active conflict front almost between the de facto authorities in the north of Yemen and the Saudi authorities, they have to figure out a way to cross the border, which is also difficult and dangerous.
And that all sounds like a description of the way things worked before COVID. COVID has come along now, and their experience now in trying to move through Yemen is even more arduous because they're viewed, is it, as a potential threat or carrier of COVID? How has that manifested itself?
COVID globally has affected how we migrate, how many people are moving, how many flights are being taken, but also how many people are making these irregular, dangerous journeys. There's increased border and security presence in the Horn of Africa and also in Yemen, also at the Saudi border. So all along the route, there's more obstacles for migrants to make this irregular and dangerous journey. So we've seen a massive reduction. So from February to June of this year, there's been about a 90% decrease in the amount of people arriving from Horn of Africa in Yemen. But despite this, we still have a lot of migrants in Yemen who started their journey either before before the COVID restrictions came in, or were already maybe living in Yemen for an extended period. And these people are feeling the effects of xenophobia and discrimination related to COVID-19. This happened before as well with the cholera outbreaks. Often the rhetoric inside Yemen is that migrants brought cholera to the country, and there's no evidence to support this. It's the same with COVID-19. There is no evidence to show that one population group more than the other is transmitting the disease or bringing the disease to other countries. It affects everyone in the same way. So that's sort of on the sort of local level with the local community. But then we can also look at how the authorities are reacting to migrants as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both north and south, we're seeing increased detention and arrests of migrants.
What conditions are they being held in when you say detention and arrest?
They could be arrested and detained in a prison. But again, it wouldn't be like the prisons we have in Ireland. It would be multiple people in the same room. Obviously, there's no physical distancing. There's not people wearing masks. There's no access to clean water. So they could also be held in buildings that are repurposed for detention centres. We saw this last year where the authorities in Aden rounded up 5,000 people and held them in a stadium, a sports stadium, which had been bombed out during the conflict and was falling down around the migrants. The problem is in the north, where there are a lot of detention centres, we just don't have access to them because of access constraints put in place by the authorities themselves, and also where a lot of them are located. They're located often in Saada, which is the governorate at the border with Saudi, which again is quite a dangerous place because the authorities in the north and Saudi do not, it's basically an active front because of the relationship between those two authorities. But what we can say from the reports we are getting from migrants ourselves is that the conditions are not good, but we do know that it's more worrying with COVID because there's no social distancing, there's no access to clean water, there's no access to hygiene supplies like soap.
By your estimates, there are, what, 14,500 Ethiopian migrants currently stuck inside Yemen. So what can be done to alleviate what they're going through? I mean, are you setting up transit camps that these people could be better treated in? Or, you know, what's the funding situation in order for people to be able to do that? What relief is needed and what's the state of play with that?
So we are estimating that there are 14,000 Ethiopian migrants stranded across Yemen. Part of these people are stuck because they've tried to continue their journey to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And another portion of these people have been forcibly transferred from the northern governorates to the south. For example, they'll be transferred from Sana'a to another governorate called Taz, and then they make their ways to Aden City, which is the largest city in the south. So we have both people who are stuck because they can't continue on their route, and then other people who are being forced out of certain areas of Yemen into other areas. And that's how we get 14,500 people. They are in dire conditions. They need immediate support. So our organization, IOM, the International Organization for Migration, is doing that. We provide emergency healthcare. We also provide emergency water and food. But that's just like a bandage on a massive wound. We need more to be addressed at the root cause of this issue. So if we look at the bigger picture, what needs to be done is, one, anyone who is asking to go home, we need to open up the airspace for them to do that. Our organization provides what we call voluntary humanitarian returns from Yemen for migrants. And now with COVID, we're getting increased requests from migrants to return back to Ethiopia, but we can't help them at the moment because of COVID travel restrictions. So we are advocating for governments and authorities to open up that airspace for us to be able to help these people who want to go home. People are literally sleeping on the side of the road in abandoned buildings and don't have any access to healthcare. So they're in a very dangerous situation. At the moment, IOM is massively underfunded like other organizations. We're looking at a funding shortage of about 50% of what we need to carry out our assistance to migrants, but also displaced people, displaced Yemenis for the end of this year. It means that without additional funding, about 2.5 million people won't get the assistance they need. So obviously this will massively affect how much help we can give to these migrants, particularly if they don't get to return home soon and continue to live in such dire conditions. Without additional funding, we can't provide the life-saving support that we normally would in such a situation.
Okay, thanks a million, Olivia. And that's it for another episode. I'm taking some leave, so we'll be back in early August, in time for the next phase of lifting of restrictions, or not, as the case may be. In the meantime, stay safe and well. Slán.